This is Girl on the River, the podcast. Whole crew, come forward to row. Hello and welcome back to Girl on the River, the podcast for episode 14. Now, I had promised you the hosts of the Steady State podcast as my guests this week, but I've actually moved that episode back a week. The reason for this is that this week is Eating Disorders Awareness Week. And when my guest, Dr. Carolyn Plateau, said she was able to come on the show, I couldn't pass up the opportunity because she's a real expert on this important subject. Carolyn is a senior lecturer in sports psychology at Loughborough University, and she has a particular interest and specialism in eating disorders and disordered eating in the athlete population. As Carolyn explains in the interview, eating disorders are far more prevalent than you might imagine in athletes. And as you'll hear in the interview, the stats are actually quite shocking. Eating disorders are potentially incredibly dangerous, so it's a really important subject to address. Now, full disclosure, I do have a personal interest in this subject. A close family member of mine has had an eating disorder. And although I've never had a full-blown eating disorder myself, I have been prone to disordered eating at various points in my life, and I've certainly struggled with my body image. As Carolyn explains, there's a spectrum, and I would say I'm definitely on it, albeit at the lower end. This is not an easy thing to admit to, as there's still a massive stigma around eating disorders. But the best way to counter a stigma is to talk about it. So there it is. Anyway, let's dive in and let me introduce you to Dr. Carolyn Plateau. So Carolyn, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me to be on. It's very exciting and a topic I'm very passionate about. So really looking forward to chatting to you today.
Well, it's a subject close to my heart as well, as you know, and I'm curious to know what it was that brought you into this particular field. I know that you have quite an athletic history of your own, so let's start with that.
Yes, I was a junior international runner, so I ran over 800 and 1500 meters when I was a junior athlete. So I spent a lot of time when I was an adolescent training, competing, traveling, and still, you know, run to this day, which is brilliant. Sadly, not at the level that I used to be. But yeah, so I was competing as a junior international athlete. And, you know, partly through some of my experiences and observations of being involved in sport at a high level, I became really interested in some of the pressures around eating and body size and body shape that happen across lots of different sports, not just running. And was really interested in pursuing or understanding why it seems to be such a problem and what we can do about it. You know, I've always come at this area from a kind of, okay, how can we try to solve this problem? Because it doesn't seem to be going away. And even since I've, you know, been working in this from a more academic role, it just uncovers how tricky this is in terms of trying to change some of the practices and the cultural issues that seem to be quite pervasive in our elite sport environment.
And in terms of statistics, do we have any idea of the prevalence of eating disorders and disordered eating, both in the population at large and in the sporting world?
Yeah, so it's always tricky, I think, when we talk about statistics for eating problems, because I'm sure, as you well know, that they're often quite difficult for people to admit to having an eating problem. So I always treat some of these statistics with a bit of a pinch of salt, but also suggest that perhaps they're a little bit of an underestimate sometimes of perhaps the true nature of the problem. In the general population, we generally work on statistics that suggest around 1 to 2% who will present with a clinical eating disorder. So that's a severe eating problem that requires usually some form of intervention and treatment. Things like anorexia nervosa, bulimia nervosa will fall into that category. In athlete populations, you're looking at close to 1 in 5 female athletes or 1 in 12 male athletes. So significantly increased in comparison to the general population.
And are there particular sports that are especially, I imagine there's some sports that are more affected than others?
Yeah, so generally it seems to be that we see higher prevalence statistics in sports that are we would typically refer to them as kind of lean sports. And by that, I mean sports where there is some kind of emphasis on weight, shape or appearance in terms of a potential performance benefit. So sports that might fall into that category include things like endurance sports, where often being lighter is believed to confer some form of advantage. Sports where there is some kind of weight categorization, so where there's some weight dependency requirements, things like martial arts or any where there's kind of categories in which athletes are required to compete at, and sports where there's an aesthetic component as well, so often where it's quite subjective in terms of the outcomes and appearance kind of forms a component of a final score, for example, gymnastics or figure skating. We often see particularly high levels of eating problems in sports which fall into those lean categories. But that's not to say that they don't happen in non-lean sports. And you know, I think it's always really important to get that message across that if you're a coach or a practitioner working in a sport where typically we wouldn't say the risk was necessarily as high, I would still be vigilant for eating problems because they do occur in across the board.
So in rowing, I suppose our most vulnerable people must be the lightweight rowers who have to make a specific weight. And then, of course, coxes. Interestingly, a lot of people don't know that the coxing specified weights are a minimum. We don't have a maximum weight, we have a minimum. And that's, I imagine, I don't know for sure, but I would imagine that's to ensure that people don't feel under pressure to get below a particular weight. But the weights are still low. It's between 50 and 55 kilos, depending on which crew you're coxing. So we're talking very, very low weights.
Yeah.
But it's, yeah, that's a really important point that it can be across the board. I suppose people imagine that in open weight sports, it's not likely to come up.
Yeah, and it still can, you know, there are still pressures within the sporting environment, regardless of whether or not you're competing in a lean sport or a non-lean sport. And those pressures can affect people in different ways. And, you know, there's eating disorders are really complex disorders, and it's not usually just one thing that contributes to the occurrence of that problem. It can be usually as a result of a multifactorial model. You know, there's lots of different things that can contribute to the occurrence of an eating disorder at a particular point in time for a particular person. So, you know, I always say to treat some of these statistics with caution, because they don't necessarily reflect the individual experience. And as we know, you know, yes, the sporting environment can certainly contribute to the occurrence of some of these problems, but it's not always, it won't be the only factor that has had a part to play there.
So let's define our terms so we know exactly what we're talking about here. Help us with what an eating disorder is and what disordered eating is.
Okay, so when we're, it does get fuzzy, and I think it's really useful to kind of define these so that we know what we're talking about. So clinical eating disorders are severe psychological disorders that are characterized by an extremely distorted relationship with food. And that can manifest in lots of different ways. So it can manifest in a kind of anorexia nervosa type profile, which is often characterized by severe restriction of food and severe underweight. It can manifest in relation to binging and purging behaviors, which would be more typical of a bulimia nervosa type eating disorder, where often weight is actually fairly normal or even above normal, but it's the kind of chaotic approach to eating that is characterizes those types of disorders. Clinical eating disorders, as I said, usually require some form of intervention and treatment. They are significantly or have particularly negative impacts on someone's physical health, obviously their psychological health, and they can be quite difficult to treat. So it can be chronic often, it can be pervasive, and it can take an awful lot of time and energy to try and tackle those disorders. Eating problems generally exist on a spectrum. So that's very much a small portion of the population with kind of these clinical eating problems at the very kind of far end of that eating spectrum. Disordered eating kind of happens a little bit before that. So typically we refer to it as subclinical when we're talking about disordered eating. So it's not necessarily meeting those thresholds for to meet a diagnosis of a clinical eating disorder. So perhaps an individual has a dysfunctional relationship with food but isn't necessarily really underweight, or perhaps they are binging and purging but only occasionally, or they're managing to function fairly well in their day-to-day lives but still have a kind of disturbed relationship with food. So it's kind of the bit before you kind of progress on to a clinical eating disorder.
And does it happen that people move from one to the other? Do people move from one type of eating disorder to another, and can they move from disordered eating into an eating disorder?
Yeah, so disordered eating is actually one of the strongest predictors for a subsequent clinical eating disorder. So if we spot someone with disordered eating, then it's usually really important to intervene at that stage and to try and prevent it from escalating to a clinical eating disorder. So it's more than kind of just dieting. It is a little bit more severe than that, and can often dieting comes before disordered eating, which then becomes before a clinical eating disorder. But your point about kind of can people move between eating disorders, so perhaps they might initially present with a kind of restrictive type profile where they're not eating very much, or they're cutting out major food groups. Often people will perhaps start with that, and then they can evolve absolutely into other types of eating problems, perhaps characterized more by binging or purging behaviors. And I think from an academic perspective, the causes of eating problems, whether or not they present as more anorexic type behaviours or more bulimic type behaviours, the causes are broadly the same, and the treatments are often bear some similarities. So it doesn't always matter necessarily what diagnosis you've got. It just needs to be addressed in some way, shape or form.
And talking about the causes, what do we know about what causes an eating disorder?
Yeah, so as I said, it's quite complicated. There's lots of different things that can contribute towards an eating disorder happening. And I don't think it's always necessarily helpful to kind of reduce it and say, well, this was the cause of a particular eating disorder, because there's usually lots of things that have contributed towards the development of that problem. We know there's some genetic factors, for example. There's growing interest, certainly, in trying to understand potential genetic vulnerabilities towards eating problems. Often it's usually a combination between perhaps genetic vulnerability with environmental factors. It can be things like stresses, particularly, that perhaps happen in an environment. Maybe from an athlete perspective, it could be an injury. It could be a change in coaching setup. It could be poor performances. It could be a whole host of things that kind of contribute towards their concerns about their body or their size or their shape. And sometimes it can be as a result of perhaps comments from individuals. So perhaps being told they need to lose weight, or being told that they need to aspire to look more like somebody else who perhaps is a role model in their particular sport. So I think generally in lots of our sporting environments, there's definitely an emphasis on kind of what people look like and drawing comparisons about how good someone is simply by the way they look, not necessarily on the basis of their performance. And that fuels this kind of unhealthy obsession with what athletes look like and the importance of that in terms of their ultimate goals and performances.
And how, I'm just thinking about how people sometimes feel when they encounter an eating disorder, perhaps amongst a friend or family member. I think in a lot of cases, there's a feeling that it must be that they must be deeply troubled, that they must come from a very troubled family, that it doesn't happen to people in kind of secure, loving families. Is that a misconception?
Yeah, eating disorders can affect anyone. And, you know, there's no rhyme or reason sometimes as to why an individual develops an eating disorder. I think there's been a lot of research that's focused on young females, adolescent females, and a lot of research has been done to kind of explore whether or not that group of the population are particularly vulnerable, and there certainly seems to be some evidence for that. But that's not to say that perhaps male athletes and others who might be viewed initially as kind of more atypical won't suffer from an eating problem, because they absolutely can. And it, as I said, it's not, sometimes it has absolutely nothing to do with a family environment. Sometimes it has nothing to do with sport even. Sometimes it can be as a result of just too many pressures all kind of coinciding at the wrong point. And eating or managing or controlling eating or changing eating comes a mechanism by which to manage some of those stresses or those issues. So, yeah, it's not like there's a kind of one size fits all approach when it comes to trying to understand how or why an eating disorder has developed. It really is a kind of case by case basis.
That's incredibly helpful. And I think it's really important for people to understand that, because I think sometimes people are slow to intervene and get help because they think it couldn't possibly be happening in their family or in their circle of friends or whatever, because that's not the kind of thing that happens to them. They're too well adjusted or whatever. So that's really helpful to know. Just looking at some other myths around eating disorders, obviously you've touched on the fact that boys and men can get them. And I think that's important to underline, isn't it? Because I think, again, that can be a barrier to diagnosis.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, from a research perspective, historically, lots of the evidence has focused on just females and often tried to apply female models to trying to understand and identify when eating problems exist in males. And I'm not sure that was ever a particularly helpful approach to, because eating disorders will manifest in different ways according to sex. And, you know, when we talk about anorexia nervosa and bulimia nervosa, the presentation of those eating disorders will vary according to sex. And in males, we see perhaps greater tendencies towards kind of compulsive exercise traits, concerns with muscularity, which perhaps contrast quite significantly with leanness and desire for thinness that we see in females. So I think it's really important to acknowledge that eating disorders do happen in males and boys, but they don't always necessarily present in the way that you might expect, you know, from a kind of more stereotypical perspective. And it's important to be vigilant and to you know, when you have concerns or you have worries, to try and tackle those at an early stage, because that is the most important thing in terms of trying to break that link between disordered eatings and these subclinical eating problems with the subsequent onset of a more serious clinical eating problem.
Well, let's look at that moment when someone, I know in eating disorder circles, people talk about someone going down the rabbit hole. Yeah. What is going on there? Because it seems to me from my own experience that there's a point at which you kind of lose them, that any of the normal things that might help someone with a mental health problem just don't work anymore because they're too far gone. So what is going on? Is there something changing in the brain or what is it?
Yeah, and again, it's difficult to kind of pinpoint. It can vary according to individuals, but I would say people distorted or disturbed eating practices become habitual over time. So the longer that people engage with unhealthy or problematic eating practices, the longer they become ingrained and the more difficult it is to then kind of remember or recall what a normal eating practice is. So this is why early intervention is so, so important when it comes to kind of breaking some of those habits and breaking those cycles with people who are suffering with eating problems, because the kind of more habitual or the more frequently those behaviours have been engaged in, the more difficult it is to then bring them back to a place where they can eat or have a more normal relationship with food. And we know being underweight or, you know, not having enough food, being in this kind of starvation cycle, can affect cognition. It can affect, you know, the way that we think. And again, that makes it more difficult to kind of adopt a common sense approach. You know, I'm not suggesting that we would necessarily endorse that in a kind of therapeutic way, but it's just actually trying to tackle an eating problem gets more difficult if the body is really undernourished and underfueled.
And how dangerous is it for someone to develop an eating disorder? What actually are the physical and mental dangers to someone?
Yeah, so eating disorders, when it comes to psychological disorders, they're one of the most serious in relation to potential outcomes of mortality. So particularly anorexia nervosa, we see elevated levels of death as a consequence of the disorder for those who are suffering with a clinical eating disorder. And that can happen in bulimia nervosa as well, due to the kind of disruption to the body's biochemistry as a result of purging behaviours. So very serious in some cases in terms of some of the physical outcomes. From an athletic perspective, from a sporting perspective, being underfueled or having this very chaotic relationship with food will significantly affect one's ability to recover between training sessions or competitions. It will compromise coordination, it will compromise concentration, psychological well-being is also affected. So individuals will often be experience low mood, often as a result of being underfueled. And it can also impact on all the body systems, essentially. You know, for females, we would, particularly for anorexic type eating disorders, we would expect to see a cessation in the kind of menstrual cycle. That can often occur because the body is prioritizing energy for other sources and for more important activities within the body. But things like cardiovascular health, gut health, all of those body systems essentially become compromised when we're not eating enough. And you know, the REDS model, or relative energy deficiency in sport model, points towards all these different systems in the body that are compromised as a result of underfueling. And essentially, when we're talking about disordered eating or an eating disorder, those consequences become exacerbated, or they become more concerning. And unsurprisingly, an athlete will experience quite significant physical complications, psychological complications, and also performance will also often likely reduce as a result of lots of those things combining together.
I had a really worrying statistic yesterday. I was at a webinar about women's health in sport and how it needs to be taken very seriously. And one of the speakers was saying that in one piece of research, 30% of female athletes were reporting some disruption to their periods at some point. So presumably that's a big red flag, is it?
It is a big red flag in terms of not always necessarily clear why that's happened. And for some athletes, it can be completely unrelated to their energy state. But for quite a few athletes, it's probably linked to energy availability. So as I described, when the body is experiencing underfueling, so there's not enough energy basically in the body to support all of the body systems that are going on, that is one of the first systems to basically slow down or stop. So if the menstrual cycle becomes longer or disappears completely, then it can sometimes indicate that there's not enough energy to sustain both the training activity and also the other systems in the body that require energy in order to be able to work. So I think, you know, there is becoming a bit more of a discussion and a kind of environment in which we can talk about the menstrual cycle and kind of how it's linked to some of these important fueling strategies in female athletes. But it is a really useful marker for people to kind of get the handle on and to monitor and to see, you know, if it is fluctuating or changing or it has disappeared, then is it a nutritional issue? Is there something going on there which might be potentially driving that?
And in terms of BMI, I've heard anecdotally about people going to their GP, perhaps with a teenage child who they're worried about, and the GP takes one look at them or weighs them, calculates their BMI and says, well, I don't think there's anything to worry about because you're not thin enough or you're not so underweight that I'm concerned. Why is that a problem in terms of understanding how the pattern develops?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is challenging. The funding and the resource available for eating disorder treatment is scarce, and there are really long waiting lists to seek support in the NHS in this country. So it's very difficult. And I think BMI is often used as a marker, as a means for which to access some of that support. That's not necessarily helpful, and it's particularly not helpful to athletes when we're thinking that actually, you know, just having a higher proportion of muscle will often make that BMI higher than perhaps in a non-athlete comparator. So it's problematic because it essentially sends the message that you need to get worse before we can help you, when actually lots of the evidence is telling us that the earlier we can intervene, the earlier we can provide support, the less likely that some of these disorders will become chronic and the easier that they will be to treat and to manage. So it's absolutely problematic. It's difficult because of constraints on our systems, but it absolutely sends the wrong message to the individual who's gone, you know, in good faith to a doctor to seek support, to then not be able to go and go on and access that as is required is very frustrating.
So let's have a look at the signs and symptoms and red flags that we should be looking for. So in terms of, you know, what parents and coaches should be looking out for.
Eating disorders are typically quite difficult to detect, and that's often because the individual can feel quite secretive or often deny that there's any problems going on. But I would always say, you know, listen to your intuition and think about, if you're concerned that something is wrong, then be persistent and be vigilant and seek support as necessary. In terms of some of the signs, eating disorders can affect a whole range of domains. So they can affect an individual's physical health, and perhaps that presents as weight loss if restrictive eating practices are at play. So perhaps a young athlete might decide to cut out certain food groups, perhaps under the umbrella or the view of becoming healthier or trying to adopt a healthier diet. But I would say, you know, it's concerning if that's fundamental food groups that will be essential in supporting growth and development and also potentially high levels of training activity. So if they're changing attitudes towards their food intake, reluctance to eat with others, perhaps at mealtimes, that can be with their peers or it can be with a family, and changing attitudes towards food in kind of mealtime type environments. Evidence of binging behavior, so that could be empty packets of food which might get stashed, or evidence of eating large volumes of food and feeling out of control as a result of that binging episode, and evidence of purging behavior as well. So if you suspect that someone is perhaps engaging in excessive exercise activity or using laxatives or engaging in self-induced vomiting, again, those can be warning signs of a more serious problem. But equally, look out for things like change in mood. Often people who are in the early stages or throes of an eating disorder might be experiencing changes to their psychological well-being. So less likely to be sociable, perhaps presenting with mood swings or difficulty kind of managing some of their emotions. Depression, anxiety, those types of symptoms are very common in co-occurring with eating disorders. From an athletic perspective, if you're a coach, you might be thinking, well, I don't often see them at mealtimes, or, you know, I'm not privy to what they eat or when they eat it. So some of the red flags within the training environment can be things like increased vulnerability to things like niggles, so injuries, or whether those are kind of severe bone related, stress related injuries, or whether they're just frequent annoyances, which could indicate perhaps a tendency not to be recovering particularly well in between sessions, again perhaps nutritionally as a result of underfueling. Things like tendencies towards infection, so constantly fighting off colds, appearing lethargic, struggling to kind of perhaps train and compete at the level that they previously have been. That's always a difficult one, because often people can be in the early stages of an eating disorder, particularly if they lose weight, their performance might actually improve, which is slightly contradictory. So they may, as a result of a kind of increased strength to power ratio, they might actually temporarily experience an increase in performance depending on what sport they're involved in. But certainly, you know, that won't often last very long, particularly if the eating disorder is developing. So be mindful of kind of changes in performance and those things, as well as kind of possible red flags there.
That's really, really helpful. So if a parent, or, well, let's start with parents, because they're usually the people who will spot things earliest. If they're concerned about something that's going on at home, they feel like there's some flags being raised, what are the do's and don'ts?
Yeah, so I would always say to a parent who's perhaps worried about a child is to approach the situation sensitively, cautiously. Try not to use terms like eating disorder or labels, which can be often quite inflammatory and difficult for an individual to get their head around. But be persistent, and, you know, don't be tempted to kind of let it lie if your intuition and your gut is telling you there's still a problem here, something doesn't seem to be quite right. To try and have open, honest conversations with the child and see if you can get to the bottom of perhaps why they perhaps started behaving differently, or if you have any concerns about their food consumption or whatever it is that's kind of flagged up as a potential problem initially. Try to convince the individual to seek support, perhaps with your backing, whether that's a visit to the GP or whether it's engaging with perhaps the performance team that if you're involved, if your child is involved in sport, can you, is there someone at a club or regional or national level that might be able to advise and give guidance on nutrition initially, perhaps, or even psychological support if it's deemed necessary, that would be useful. And, you know, don't struggle alone. Try and reach out for support through other networks. There's some fantastic eating disorder charities in the UK, BEAT being one, First Steps ED being another. There are many others. And seek guidance and support through those mechanisms as best as you can.
I think there can be a real fear of medicalizing it, which perhaps puts people off from actually taking action. I know when it sort of happened in our family, the GP was kind of the last resort, which was, looking back, a mistake. We sort of went down the route of sports nutritionists and all sorts of things, anything, but actually acknowledging what was going on. You know, don't be afraid of talking to the GP and getting CAMHS involved or whoever it is, because you're more likely to get out of it without medical intervention the earlier you get involved in it.
Yeah, very true. And, you know, the GP is in this country is a very important gateway to other sources of support and more intense forms of support as well. And whilst, you know, some of our research has shown that the GPs often don't understand athletes, or they find it a bit more difficult to manage when an athlete presents with some of these issues, be persistent. As I've said, you know, keep going back. If you're not getting the answer that you want, then keep going until you do, until you get a referral to an eating disorder service, which is likely to be where most of that important support is going to be housed.
And what sort of support does that usually involve? What are the eating disorders teams made up of these days?
So there's usually there can be kind of two different kind of forms of support depending on the nature of the problem. Inpatient therapy is usually reserved for people who are very low weight and who perhaps require some medical intervention to support weight stabilization before kind of really intensive counselling or support that way. Some or eating disorders where there is perhaps less concern about the weight status of the individual can often be managed on an outpatient basis or even on a daycare type basis, where an individual spends the day times at the centre and they might have their meals there and also engage in group therapy or individual therapy whilst they're there to help them often stabilise their eating patterns if they have become quite chaotic. Often that can be quite a useful approach to doing that. For people under the age of 18, often one of the approaches will be family-based therapy, so which will often involve both the parents and often the siblings as well, if there are any. And, you know, aiming to tackle the eating problem as a kind of holistic approach, so centering the individual within the family unit and helping the family understand how they can support the individual to develop a more functional relationship with food and to arm the family with strategies that they can then go away with and implement within their home environment. And family-based therapy, particularly for anorexia nervosa, for those under the age of 18, is particularly effective. So it is a good option for lots of people.
So really, it's nothing to be afraid of. You're talking about psychiatrists, psychologists, and dietitians. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, they'll probably form the core team within an eating disorder unit. You'll get counsellors and therapists within there as well. And, you know, I think that can often be a challenging environment for an athlete. From our own research, athletes tell us that it's very difficult sometimes going into an eating disorder unit environment because they feel very different perhaps to some of the other clients and people that are in there. But I think it's important to pursue that. And actually, you may, as an individual, have to put your sporting goals and aspirations on hold temporarily whilst you seek support and treatment in order to make sure that your body is strong enough to be able to manage intensive training and competition later on.
So that's parents and families. What about coaches? It's quite sensitive for them, I imagine, if they've got someone. And I imagine there's a lot of fear around doing and saying the wrong thing. So are there protocols that sporting coaches are provided with? Or if not, what should they do?
Yeah, I think it's really difficult for coaches, particularly in the UK, where lots of our coaches are working voluntarily. You know, they are involved in sport for the love of sport very often, and perhaps dedicate a couple of evenings a week and then, you know, go to their full-time job the rest of the time. And, you know, managing or supporting an athlete with an eating problem probably wasn't high up on their list of things that they wanted to do whilst they were involved in sport. So it is very challenging from a coaching perspective. And I think historically there's often been a lot of blame placed on coaches, which again I don't think is necessarily helpful, and it rather minimizes very often the causes of the eating problem and the, you know, the fact that it's caused by lots of different things. And perhaps, yes, a coach may have made a comment at some point and that's escalated, but it's not usually the only thing that's contributed to that. And actually coaches can very much be part of the solution when it comes to managing eating problems in athletes. You know, they're often one of the individuals that has the most contact with the individual. They might be the person that perhaps notices something isn't quite right at an early stage. And I think one of the key things is about making sure coaches are confident in what to do next. Because from our research with coaches, they tell us that it's often that uncertainty about what to do next that stops them from taking action at an early stage. And also, you know, the worry that comes with, have I done something wrong? Is this, you know, is this as a result of X, Y, and Z? So one of my missions, I suppose, has been to try and educate coaches a little bit more about some of the signs and symptoms around eating psychopathology in athletes, and to give them some kind of tools and things that they can use to be able to help them in that initial, okay, now what do I do? How do I deal with this? Who do I need to signpost to? Because no one is asking coaches to be a therapist or to diagnose an eating problem. That is absolutely not their role. Their role is more in as a supporter, and being able to signpost that individual to appropriate sources of support. Those are the key things to make sure that the eating disorder is tackled at an earlier stage as possible in order to prevent that kind of possible escalation of symptoms. Again, you know, some of the key points I would say to coaches is trust your instinct, trust your gut. If you think something's not quite right, then say something, have a conversation. Obviously think about where and when and how you do that. So not in front of the rest of the training group, you know, privately, confidentially, sensitively. Again, think about language. Refer to the problem as something shared rather than something that's solely the athlete's. And avoid inflammatory terminology like in eating disorder or things like that, which can be quite stigmatizing or quite difficult for an athlete to hear if they haven't heard it from anybody before. And, you know, try to agree a strategy with the athlete. If they're open and willing to have that conversation with you, try to agree what the next steps are going to be and how you're going to support them in that, whether it's seeking guidance from a GP, whether it's going to the medical support personnel within your club or your governing body. And, you know, have an open and honest discussion about the impact that might have on their training and their competition whilst they seek guidance and around the eating problem. Athletes can sometimes respond quite well if you frame it in terms of performance rather than necessarily just health. You know, if you talk about the needing to get them strong for competition or needing to develop their strength and their endurance for their future career, rather than necessarily just focusing on your concerns or worries around their health, which is often not first and foremost in an athlete's mind.
Yeah, and that's sort of more authentic coming from a coach as well, isn't it? If they talk about what they normally talk about, which is, you know, aiming towards the next competition or whatever the training is that they're doing.
Yeah, exactly. And it's putting it in language and that an athlete can understand and that is on board with. You know, they're likely still have goals and aspirations to be a successful athlete. If they're still involved in the training group, they just need some support and guidance on how to achieve that. And having an eating disorder doesn't prohibit someone from going on to be extremely successful if we can catch it at an early stage and offer that support when it's needed in order to prevent those symptoms becoming overly severe.
And you and your team have worked on some training for coaches. So tell me about that, because I think this is really exciting and important.
Yeah, so as a result of some of the research that we've done with coaches who, you know, the constant message that we were getting, both from them, from governing bodies, from athletes, was, we don't know enough about this. We don't know what we're looking for. We don't know how to deal with it. We don't know where we're signposting to. And typically within the sporting landscape within the UK, eating disorders are not covered as part of kind of coach, typical standard coach education protocols. So we felt it was really important to try and fill this gap and to make sure that there was a resource out there for coaches to engage with and to raise awareness around the types of things that they need to be looking out for with their athletes. And also to give them some hints and tips on creating a kind of positive climate under which to look after their athletes. And you know, we're not saying don't ever talk about weight or don't ever mention this, because that's not healthy either. It's about trying to create positive fueling strategies, you know, endorsing healthy practices and building positive relationships between food and performance in the athletes that they work with. So yes, our online course is available at the moment, and if coaches are interested and they want to go through that, it takes about three hours or so to work through the modules that we've put together, with lots of advice and guidance on having some of those conversations with athletes that you're worried about, signposting, spotting some of those signs and symptoms. And yeah, it's my mission to try and make sure that coaches engage with some of this content, just so that they can prepare themselves in the event that they do come across an athlete who might be suffering with an eating problem.
Because the likelihood is they will at some point in their career, isn't it?
Absolutely. You know, if you look at the statistics, one in five female athletes, one in 12 male athletes. And I think that's probably just the tip of the iceberg. There are many others who perhaps don't meet some of those clinical criteria who would still benefit from guidance and support around their eating practices. So it is essential in my view that the coaches are aware that these problems do exist in sport. And, you know, if we try and think longer term, changing the culture in sport, changing the emphasis in sport around weight and shape is going to be one of the core ways in which we can try and prevent the occurrence of these disorders in future. And our coaching workforce, sports professionals, are all going to be instrumental in trying to change that landscape for future generations of athletes to come.
That's absolutely brilliant. Well, I'll put details of that course in the show notes. And is there any message, if there's anyone from British Rowing, our governing body, or Welsh Rowing or Scottish Rowing or Rowing Ireland, if any of them happen to be listening, is there anything that you would love to get across to them, anything that they ought to be doing or thinking about?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's reinforcing some of the messages that we've obviously talked about today in terms of, you know, creating a cultural environment, a sporting culture in which is safe and which is positive in relation to weight and eating and food for our athletes, in order to protect both their long-term health, but also to enhance their performance. You know, I think it can't go overstated really how important healthy fueling is for healthy, happy, strong athletes and people of the future. So prioritizing this area in terms of education, awareness, events, you know, encouraging athletes who perhaps have previously experienced concerns around their eating to speak out, because then it makes it easier for other people to also come forward and talk about their worries and concerns. And yeah, I think that's probably there's many things, but I think those are probably the core ones. Let's think about raising awareness and promoting positive food cultures within sport if we can.
Well, that's something that is really interesting, you know, how careful we need to be around language. And, you know, when we're talking about weight and we're talking about food, you said not that it would be weird and unhealthy never to refer to it. So is there anything we ought to definitely not say in front of our athletes or our young people? And because I'm thinking about, you know, just throwaway remarks we might make, you know, someone will be having a big meal and then they'll talk about needing to work it off. And, you know, yeah, I've been at events, perhaps where I'm coxing and someone will just make a jokey comment saying, oh, I hope you're not eating lunch. How careful do we need to be?
Yeah, I mean, I think it depends on who you're talking to, but be aware that particularly, you know, young people are and young athletes are highly impressionable and are, I think we forget sometimes how much of that they absorb. And, you know, I'm not saying you need to think about everything you say, but I am saying that actually something that might appear like a throwaway comment to you could be interpreted very differently by a young person who is perhaps already experiencing body dissatisfaction or concerns around their eating or weight or shape. I mean, there are some examples of poor practice whereby, you know, you draw comparisons between different athletes in the same training group, or, you know, perhaps compare notes on skin folds or whatever it is, which, you know, those types of practices I'm sure are hopefully a thing of the past, but some extreme examples of how you know, that can be extremely unhelpful if you have someone in your training group that you don't know about who might be experiencing some concerns. So I think it's always being mindful that something that is banter or throwaway comments for one individual is not necessarily the same for somebody else. So, I mean, I would just say, you know, avoid making some of those comparisons between whether it's members of the same training group or comparisons with role models. You know, accept that good performances can come from athletes at every size, and they don't have to fit a one size fits all mold in order to be successful. You know, look for evidence of athletes who perhaps, you know, are different and don't necessarily conform to the mold, and use those as inspiration rather than kind of always sticking with what we know, all the stereotypes that exist within our particular sports. So, yeah, I mean, critical comments can often land very badly when we talk about weight and shape. And that's not just true in sport. It's true across the board. You know, teachers and others who are working with young people do have perhaps more influence than they would necessarily think that they do. And, you know, even if as a coach you have concerns about your body or your worries about your weight, try not to project those onto the athletes that you work with, and instead endorse positive practices, encourage refueling, try and have positive role models within your training group, whether that's as simple as encouraging athletes to bring a recovery shake, for example, after their training session, and endorsing that behavior, and encouraging athletes to go in and have something to eat relatively soon after they've finished a training session. You know, it's just incremental things and practices that you can start to gradually build into your training environment.
That's really helpful. And if there were, you know, one thing that you could do that, you know, perhaps we as a rowing body can do, you know, as members of rowing clubs, as people who rub along with young people, if there's sort of one message you'd like to get across to us, what would that be?
Oh, crikey, putting me on the spot. I think it's about, you know, understanding that the impact that underfueling can have, and that that's not just it's not just clinical eating disorders, it's not just people who experience these very severe disorders. It's about the impact that has on you systemically as an individual, both from your psychological and from your physical health. And actually, food does not have to be earned. You don't have to work it off. You don't have to be deserving of food. Food is essential for everybody, and athletes are no different. And there'll be significant benefits when it comes to performance and also their general health and well-being, not just as an athlete, but also as, you know, when they eventually retire and progress on, you know, that can't be overstated. They can have huge long-term impacts, eating disorders, and it's not worth it in the short run.
Yeah, I'm sometimes a little concerned about the healthy eating messages that we put out to young people, because obviously obesity is a major health problem for us as a society. But at the same time, in an effort to address that, I do worry a little bit that sometimes we overdo the healthy, sort of unhealthy idea. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, and I think it's a really tricky public discourse that public health discourses that we have to navigate. And I'm, you know, there's an awful lot of messaging around, as you said, around obesity, around the importance of exercise, the emphasis on exercise, the emphasis on, you know, not over consuming food. And often those messages are, whilst they're important in terms of trying to encourage a healthier nation, they're often picked up by people who don't need to listen to those messages at all. And, you know, they become internalized, and people can develop eating disorders as a result of kind of some of these pervasive public health messages that actually don't always land in the right place. And, you know, there is a real disconnect sometimes between some of the obesity public health messaging and some of the eating disorders work that's going on. You know, yes, we have huge proportions of the population who would benefit from support around overeating or under-exercising, but there's even just because it's a smaller group of the population doesn't mean that those with eating disorders don't get affected by some of this rhetoric that exists within our landscape. I'm not sure what the solution is. It's just but it is really it's really difficult, and it does conflict certainly with some of the messages that are out there in regards to kind of promoting positive healthy eating practices that we would endorse within a from an eating disorder perspective, compared to some of that obesity public health messaging that does exist.
So it's really about balance, isn't it? Just, you know, watching, being mindful of what we say, modelling kind of healthy behaviour ourselves in terms of balanced diet involving every kind of food, no exactly. Bad foods, but just in moderation.
Yeah, precisely. And you know, I think weight manipulation can often be seen as a bit of a quick fix, particularly in sport. You know, it's often a quick route to success, perhaps not a particularly sustainable one, but it can be often seen to be a bit of a quick route. And I would always advocate for staying away from that. There's almost certainly 99 other things that you could do before you need to start even talking about or making changes to an athlete's weight, depending on the developmental stage, their training history, their, you know, their technique, their skill development, their weight training. There's so many other things that we could talk about and address as coaches and practitioners and others before we even start having that conversation about whether we need to start manipulating weight or making changes to body size and shape. So I would always ask yourselves, you know, have you done everything else before you start trying to make changes to weight or nutrition? Because it's that 1%. It's not necessarily relevant to the vast majority of our sportsmen and women. There's so many other things that they can do first.
Well, that's an absolutely brilliant message to end on. Thank you so much. It's been really interesting, really important, really helpful. And I know that people are going to have a lot to take away with them. So thank you, Carolyn. It's been a real pleasure.
Pleasure. Yes. Thank you for having me. I really enjoy talking about it. And yes, do reach out if anyone has any questions or would like more information on our course, then please get in touch.
Well, I'll put all of the details, how to contact you and where people can get hold of the online coaching. I'll put all of that in the show notes.
Brilliant. Thank you.
I don't know about you, but I'm really heartened to hear about the training program for coaches, and I'd ask you to share this episode with all the coaches you know, as well as parents of young athletes, because I think it's incredibly valuable. Carolyn has very generously offered a discount for group bookings, and I'll put all the details of the course and the discounts in the show notes, as well as details of further reading that Carolyn has recommended and details of eating disorder resources and charities. As always, thank you for tuning in. If you can take a moment to rate and review the podcast on Apple, that would be incredibly helpful. And you can find me on social media at Girl on the River on all channels. Next week, I promise you will have the fabulous hosts of Steady State, Tara Morgan and Rachel Friedman, and I think you'll love them. We certainly had a lot of fun recording it. And until then, next stroke, easy ore.